Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we're going to continue with our ongoing series in exploring important health issues that generally do not make the major media, and when they do, are frequently not presented in an objective and fair way. And I try to select topics from a wide variety of areas that would impact on virtually everyone in the audience. I'm going to be continuing this series for approximately 2 more weeks. And then we'll be going back to our Hidden Agenda series. I'll be completing a special in-depth investigative report on fluoridation. And I'm also completing one on genetic engineering. I have my final research completed. It's just a matter of getting it edited and ready for presentation with all the footnotes. With all my investigations, I put them up on the webpage, GaryNull.com, for you to be able to utilize and review. And so you can be aware that there's good support for the information, irrespective of how much of a controversy it may cause. This comes from Margaret Talbot. The shyness syndrome. Bashfulness is the latest trait to become a pathology. Talks about, in the social evolution of a new psychological syndrome, there may be no moment more important than the appearance of its first celebrity victims. A star, or maybe a fading star, discloses a troubling diagnosis that he or she has been struggling with in silence. The star receives warm studio audience applause and a big Hollywood hug for bravery, for just wanting to help others in the same situation. In the case of rockers and drugs, the evidence of a struggle is often kind of thin. More often it looks as if they partied really hard and then slacked off a bit when they turned 50 or 60 or the drummer died. Meanwhile, as a celeb makes the rounds of the talk shows or sits down with People magazine, the syndrome itself moves up in the world, acquiring a new high profile, maybe a catchy acronym, and a presumption that it is far more widespread than we realized. Why? Because, well, of course, a celebrity had it. This is the stage we now have reached with social anxiety disorder, also called social phobia, and colloquially known as shyness. The condition had been identified in the diagnostic manual of the Bible of psychiatric diagnosis as far back as 1980, but until recently, it was thought to be a rare disorder, characterized not only by a distracting nervousness at parties or before giving a speech, say, but also by a powerful desire to avoid such situations altogether. Then in 1999, buoyed by the success of a new psychotropic drug, the pharmaceutical company SmithKline Beecham began marketing its antidepressant Paxil as a treatment for social phobia, shyness. Public awareness campaigns equated the syndrome with an allergy to people. Experts, of course, came in, and they cited alarming new statistics. Around 13% of us were social phobic. For example, magazines dish up the requisite alarmist trend stories, a set of traits and behaviors, at least some of which were once regarded as neutral or even desirable, reemerged as a pathology, a disease, a dysfunction of the brain, chemistry, of course amenable to and indeed demanding pharmaceutical manipulation. Enter the socially anxious celebrities. Now, of course, Donny Osmond was one of the first to come forward with a full-scale confessional. Donny. Recently, for some reason, it's been athletes. The English soccer star, David Beckham, who is married to a Spice Girl, published a memoir last fall in which he admitted to being painfully shy. And last month, the New Orleans Saints running back, Ricky Williams, told reporters his social anxiety disorder had been officially diagnosed and is now medicated. Good for you, Ricky. Next time you hit the heads of those guys when you're running through the line and they're all staring you helmet to helmet, eye to eye, mud in your ear, blood in your nose, you'll know that you don't have to be anxious in that little huddle of fellas because you're on a pill. The syndrome, he said, accounted for his unusual behavior, keeping his helmet on during rookie year interviews, curling up inside his locker. It was touching. After all, when was the last time you saw a 280-pound man with a helmet on, jockstrap, cuddled up in a locker? If only he had known. Actually, to hear Williams' teammates rally around him, quote, "We're all family," a defensive tackle said. "If one of us hurts, it all hurts." How about that? Then you should all curl up in lockers together. Makes it easier for the janitor to keep the room clean. No more sweat on the floor. But it was also a reminder that it's much easier to turn on a spigot of empathy and attention these days when you can cite a diagnosed imbalance in brain chemistry rather than any eccentricity, a character flaw, or an economic disadvantage. In 2 years, then, social anxiety disorder has picked up all the needs. A psychotropic drug of choice, an army of advocates, a handful of celebrity sufferers, poor Donnie, to sustain itself is a widely recognized syndrome. And for so many people, people truly incapacitated by their fears of others' disapproval, that is a blessing. It will make it easier for them to seek help and perhaps obtain relief. And yet, there are always costs to medicalizing what is not essentially a medical condition. If extremely shy people require a pill, maybe mildly shy people could be improved by one too. Well, how about a few more outgoing types in the office? Fewer strong-willed people. Advocates of the new diagnosis are forever saying that social phobia is worse than mere shyness, but in practice, the line between them is fluid, depending upon what they are looking for subjective judgments about whether a person's social reticence causes significant distress. As an article on the subject in a recent issue of American Family Physician acknowledges, social phobia can be tricky to diagnose because, quote, the types of fears and avoidance commonly associated with it are, to some degree, experienced by most people, unquote. I took the social phobia inventory, a self-administered test offered on the Facts for Health website, among other places, including Paxil's site, whoa, and on one afternoon got the verdict that I was not socially phobic, on the next that I might be and should consult my clinician. The truth is that shyness is not exactly an objectively measurable condition or a trait or whatever it is. A generation ago, personality assessment folded into the general category of introversion and characterized neither introversion nor extroversion as pathological. In surveys taken in the 1970s and again in the 1990s, the percentages of Americans claiming to be shy jumped from 40 to nearly 50%, which suggests not some mysterious epidemic of shyness, however you define it, but more likely a shift in social values. Maybe more people feel shy in a culture in which the omnipresent media is so full of the aggressively pushy. Maybe in another generation or so, we'll find ourselves sorely missing the meek and the mild, the stoic and the quiet person among us. Is somebody out there inventing the drug to treat excessive perkiness? Margaret Talman is a fellow at the New American Foundation and a contributing editor for the magazine. Well said, Margaret. I have been suggesting for some time that virtually every single human condition has now been able to be pathologized and hence treated by drugs. Behind it is a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry. And then it makes it more difficult for people to believe that we can all have different personalities, different energy levels, and still be normal. We now look with suspect on any kid that is antsy or overly energized. It's as if we want to wake up tomorrow morning and maybe think of it. Think of what would happen if we all woke up tomorrow and we all were kind of just the same. No anger, no fear, no joy, no happiness, no emotions, no conflict. That instead of a pod from an alien species, the geneticist had put that magic new gene into our system so that we didn't have to worry about pathology anymore. We had all been diagnosed as dysfunctional. Not too far from there, in fact, just today, in one of the emails I received from the Electronic Telegraph in the United Kingdom, from Celia Hall, medical editor, gene trial patients will be genetically modifying humans. Men in Birmingham are to be turned into genetically modified organisms in an attempt to cure their prostate cancer, scientists said yesterday. The new trial, which begins next month, is the first in the world to see if a genetically engineered virus can turn prostate cancer cells into targets for anti-cancer drugs. Potentially, it promises treatment for men with early forms of the disease. First, they will be injected with a common cold virus, which has been genetically modified to carry a gene that is unique. This will produce a protein molecule in the prostate cells capable of activating the anti-cancer drug, which will be delivered later. But because the men will receive a genetically modified virus under health and safety regulations, they will become, in effect, genetically modified organisms. They'll be isolated in special rooms and seen only by doctors, nurses wearing masks and protective clothing. It's here. This is the first. Now, here's a question. Here's how I'd read it. I'd read it a little differently, though I appreciate Soya Hall's reporting. I would say that rather than look at what causes prostate cancer, which is lifestyle, which can be changed, and preventing it, rather than understanding this very slow-growing cancer has years in which you can work with changing the underlying milieu and using natural techniques from stinging nettles to saw palmetto, from vitamin C infusions to aqua vitamin A, from intravenous glutathione, reduced and activated quercetin, which has all been shown to change the cancer prognosis, that we want to make it easier for a toxic chemotherapy drug to be able to get through the blocking protein that the cancer cell uses to protect itself, and genetic engineering is going to do it. So we're going to put something that's never been done before, modified viruses that are specific to allow chemotherapy to attack an organ. That's how I would read it. Same information, different perspective. Let's continue. You've just joined us. I'm Gary Nall. And by the way, next Monday evening, I will be setting aside several hours to interview prospective producers. My producer for the past 3 years, who's done an absolutely yeoman job, Jeannie Barboza, has moved out to the West Coast. She is now living in Los Angeles and Seattle, commuting between the two. And we are now just starting the process to interview for people who'd like to be full-time producer. And if you're interested, you must contact my office, and you'll speak with the person in my office, who is Anna, my office manager. And she will do a pre-interview, and then I'll interview everyone who wants to come. But she pre-produced a lot of shows before she went, so we're still in good shape. Let's go to what Bill Falloon and Angela Parisi have to say in Life Extension, an article entitled "An Unjustified Attack on Vitamins." I know that many of you, when you see an attack in a newspaper, hear it on the radio or television, you wonder, is it legitimate? Well, understand something. There is now an ongoing program to virtually attack every vitamin, every mineral, every herb at any level, just so that we cause an enormous amount of consternation and confusion in people's minds, so they become almost terrified to take a vitamin or mineral or herb. This is not done without purpose. It's a very methodical program that will be done over the next 2 years so that Codex Alimentarius can pass, of course, all in the effort to harmonize the nutrients that they're using in Europe, which, are, by the way, if you followed a group of cockroaches that took the amount that they give them, they'd probably be dying of malnutrition. The potencies of a few of these are so low, 1.4 milligrams of vitamin B1, that they're not going to make any difference at all. But that's the point. If you want a higher potency, your physician will have to give you a prescription, and you'll be paying an enormous amount of money. Look at Norway, look at France, look at Germany as examples of this right now, and Italy. In any case, that's where they're going. That's what their intent is. We're doing all we can to try to block it. We're slowing it down. We will not be able to reverse it. It's just a delay game. I'm working on some inventions right now for the future. I'm trying to create a vitamin that will have an indefinite life, at least. I'm up right now to 10 years. I want to get it to 20 years because, quite frankly, I believe the day will come when we will not be allowed to take any of the vitamins or minerals or supplements we're currently taking. And so I'm going to be prepared so that I'm not going to be affected. So I've got a couple of years, and because I'm an inventor and because I'm always looking for things that can be improved and changed, I'm hopeful that I will come across what I need to know in order to do that. In any case, the larger issue is the sicker we are, the more we need our immune system in place, healthy, vital, with all the viruses, bacteria, infectious diseases, and they're taking away the things that we need or trying to. Before they take it away through their legislation, they first have to demonize it. You have to demonize someone before you can get other people not to respect their opinion or views. The same is true with a supplement. You hit it hard enough, you say enough bad things about vitamin C, no matter how ludicrous it is or unscientific or unsupportable, it's possible to shake people's confidence in it. And then when you finally hear someone say, look, you don't need vitamin C, you can get it from an orange juice, that's all. Then you think, okay, well, all right, I'll just get it from orange juice. And I would say then all the people I've helped in their recovery from AIDS, hepatitis, herpes, cancer, wouldn't be around today if they were trying to get their vitamin C from orange juice. So there's a reason why they're attacking these things, and the pharmaceutical companies behind it, but they're smarter today. They try to distance themselves and use their henchmen within their own trade organizations, who then make sure that they have foundations, and there's a whole group of scientists you can hire. It's much like a movie. Depending upon who you want in a movie, you go through catalogs, look at their pictures, look at their backgrounds, and you select them for a particular role. Same with scientists. The difference is that these scientists are playing a role similar to an actor. An actor's making believe. The scientist is also making believe. The make-believe is that the coal is good for you. It doesn't cause a problem. The meat's good for you. You need it. It doesn't contribute to colorectal cancer or elevated cholesterol. The sugar's good for you. It provides energy. And it's not bad for you. And now we have no shortage of these scientists. By the tens of thousands, they just keep coming. Like lemmings coming from the sea, every day they just keep popping up out of the water and saying, hi, I'm Bob, Harvard, MD, PhD, yuckity-yuck, yuckity-yuck. I'm for sale. Hey, $600 an hour plus expenses, and I've got a lot of expenses, and I'll say whatever you want me to say. I'm a whore. I'm the most expensive person you could imagine, but I'm worth it. I have no loyalty except to that dollar, my lifestyle. I have a pedigree that is so perfect. Buy it, use it, rub it around your psyche, smear it on the American consciousness. It'll protect you. And we think, okay, I heard Dr. Such and Such on. How do you know he was objective? How do you know he didn't have a vested interest? How do you know he didn't have stock in a company? How do you know that he didn't have his research grants paid for? You don't know that. And they're not telling you. The problem is that who can we trust? The FDA? Not your life. The CDC? Oh, those very ethical people that gave us the Tuskegee experiment and the swine flu vaccine? Don't think so. U.S. Public Health Service is an old boys club. It's been manipulated and controlled from its inception. If you took the cumulative IQ of everyone who works for the National Institutes of Health, you wouldn't reach today's ambient temperature. All that prestige and no ethic. There's no level these people couldn't stoop to. You think lawyers are the lowest people on earth? These people actually can slide under a door instead of going through it. And these are the people they're using for their attacks. Does the media care? Nope. You see them showing up all the time. Or on Jane Brody's columns, ad nauseum. So you see, we have very few resources. We have very few outlets. We have very few forums to try to present a balanced and objective point of view. They have enormous power, unlimited resources, and access to anyone and any place in the main policymaking and opinion-leading arena. So when enough of them tell you something's bad, the likelihood is you'll stop using it. If they tell the American public organic isn't any better, you'll begin to believe it. After all, didn't John Stossel tell us organic was no better? Well, John, you know, you made a big mistake there. He had to pay for it. Didn't mean a thing. Still back where he was. People still watching, still believing. So when I tell you that they're going after your vitamins, minerals, herbs, and they're going to use every kind of disingenuous method they can, they will. So prepare yourself for the onslaught. It will be measured and it will be specific. They'll try to distance you or scare you. Before you allow that, you have resources that you can counter that. There's over 1 million studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing these things can interface with the disease process and frequently improve or completely eradicate it or help prevent it. So look at the facts. Now, let me quote an article here from the Life Extension. I'll quote verbatim. An unjustified attack on vitamins. An article recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that high doses of vitamin E did not lower urinary measurements of lipid peroxidation in healthy people. Now, since the primary purpose of the taking of vitamin E is to protect against these kind of free radicals, the authors of this study questioned the rationale for healthy people consuming supplemental vitamin E. The media jumped all over this story and attacked the value of vitamin E supplementation. The fact that vitamin E by itself failed to demonstrate suppression of lipid peroxidation is not surprising. It has long been known that vitamin E requires other antioxidants in order to recycle itself back into the free radical scavenger stage. The people who participated in the study were screened to make sure that none of them had taken a multiple vitamin in the preceding month. During the course of the study, the subjects were not allowed to take any supplement other than prescribed vitamin E. This meant that there was no other antioxidants available to recycle vitamin E in products back into effective suppressors of free radicals. Studies published many years ago showed that for vitamin E to function as a continuous antioxidant, you got to take up the vitamin C. Vitamin C must be present to regenerate or donate more electrons to vitamin E in the body. The subjects who participated in the Journal of the American Medical Association study were not allowed to take vitamin C or any other supplement that would have enabled the vitamin E to function as an effective antioxidant. Ah, there's the rub. Set a study up to fail. Gee, would the Journal of the American Medical Association do that? Well, remember, it's been convicted of crimes, including suppression of all alternative therapies and restraint of trade against chiropractic. Had to settle for big settlement. They were found guilty. By the way, the 10 largest medical organizations in America were also found guilty in that same antitrust lawsuit. In this Journal of the American Medical Association study, the dose administered to the test subjects ranged from 400 to 1,200 units per day of alpha-tocopherol form of vitamin E. It has been established that consuming only alpha-tocopherol can lower blood levels of the more potent form of vitamin E called gamma-tocopherol. Scientists have shown that the average American's bloodstream is five times more rich in alpha-tocopherol than gamma-tocopherol, and that difference jumps 20-fold among people who take alpha-tocopherol supplements. Now, since the alpha form of vitamin E displaces the critically important gamma-tocopherol, it is understandable why people given high doses of only alpha-tocopherol would not show a reduction in lipid peroxidation. In a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, April 1997, researchers reported that it could be dangerous to take high levels of alpha-tocopherol without also consuming gamma-tocopherol. The reason for this is that too much alpha-tocopherol could deprive the cells of the gamma form of vitamin E that is needed to neutralize existing oxidizing agents such as peroxide radicals, which can be especially damaging. The scientists who wrote the National Academy of Sciences article suggest that alpha-tocopherol vitamin E supplementation should contain at least 20% gamma-tocopherol. In response to these recommendations, members of my audience have been using the mixed tocopherols where you're getting all this stuff, okay? But the authors of that study, they didn't include gamma-tocopherol, which is also vitamin E. They only use one type. There are additional pieces to the vitamin E puzzle. A series of groundbreaking studies by Roland Stocker and his colleagues at the Heart Research Institute demonstrates that vitamin E alpha-tocopherol systematically promotes LDL oxidation. That's bad. Stocker calls this pro-oxidation action of vitamin E, quote, tocopherol-mediated peroxidation, or TMP. Through the TMP process, vitamin E amplifies mild oxidative stress so that they do much more damage to LDL, low-density lipoproteins. The good news is that Stocker's group discovered that coenzyme Q10, which is an aside, would be completely banned by the FDA, not allowed in any of the international markets. Quite simply, it's one of our superstar top 10 supplements for our heart, our brain. Every American should be using coenzyme Q10 that I'm aware of, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies on the coenzyme Q10. It can save lives. It can keep a heart attack from occurring. It can repair damage that's been done. People aren't taking it. Should. Anyhow, back to the story. Stocker's group discovered that coenzyme Q10, naturally present in the body, protects against TMP. They showed that one molecule of coenzyme Q10 can prevent two chain reactions involving as many as 80 free radicals. In pilot studies, they tested LDL from the blood of human subjects given vitamin E and coenzyme Q10 together. Coenzyme Q10 reduced TMP, while vitamin E supplements increased it. When given together, the coenzyme Q10 supplements significantly counteracted the TMP side effects of the vitamin E given alone. Here is the conclusion from one of several studies that show that adequate levels of coenzyme Q10 are required for vitamin E to function as an efficient antioxidant in the body. Quote, these results demonstrate that oral supplementation with alpha-tocopherol alone results in LDL that is more prone to oxidation initiation, whereas co-supplementation with coenzyme Q10 not only prevent this pro-oxidant activity of vitamin E, but also provides the lipoprotein with increased resistance to oxidation, unquote. The work of Dr. Stocker and his colleagues agrees with other lines of recent research suggesting that coenzyme Q10 cooperates with vitamin E in a complex partnership that we are only beginning to understand. Indeed, these co-antioxidants are always found together in cell membranes and LDL. Coenzyme Q10 rejuvenates, regenerates vitamin E, which would otherwise be quickly exhausted fighting oxidative stress. Vitamin E breaks off the chain reaction of lipid peroxidation, while coenzyme Q10 helps prevent it from starting. The many studies of vitamin E supplementation published over the years did not take into account that coenzyme Q10 naturally present in the body, but we can now see that this was a crucial factor. In these studies of vitamin E, coenzyme Q10 served as the silent partner, amplifying the effect of vitamin E, regenerating vitamin E as it was exhausted and preventing TMP. Let's take a look at why this study may have been flawed. Having provided reasons why vitamin E by itself in the form of alpha tocopherol may not lower urinary measurements of free radical activity in the body, we should point out a few flaws in this Journal of the American Medical Association study that may have invalidated the findings. First of all, the vitamin E capsules were oil-based. This was not disclosed in the Journal of the American Medical Association article, and we had to call the researchers to discover this piece of information. The researchers were unable to tell us what type of oil was used in the capsules, or were they able to confirm if an antioxidant like ascorbyl palmitate was added to the capsules to protect the oil from oxidizing. Here is a quote from the description of these vitamin E supplements given to us by one of the scientists who authored the Journal of the American Association study. He said, quote, "To the best of my knowledge, it was oil-based. It was amber-colored capsule that contained a liquid preparation," unquote. Well, serious vitamin takers prefer dry powder as opposed to oil-based alpha-tocopherol because they're concerned that unprotected oil-based alpha-tocopherol may turn rancid. And while vitamin E functions as an antioxidant in the body, it does not adequately protect oil in capsules. The reason for this is that supplemental alpha-tocopherol is in an ester form and does not become a good antioxidant until it is de-esterified in your body. Had the superior dry powder alpha-tocopherol been used, the outcome of the study may have been different. There are several methods to evaluate free radical activity in the body, yet the researchers who conducted this Journal of the American Medical Association study chose to restrict their analysis to only urinary measurements. We would have preferred to see blood tests that would measure thiobarbituric acid reactive substances, plasma lipid peroxides, and other conjugated dienine formations. These blood measurements of oxidation are the gold standard by which antioxidant efficacy is measured in the body. Had these blood tests been used instead of urine tests, the results of the study may have shown some degree of protection against oxidative stress. As of press time, 92 separate studies that include vitamin E have been published in just this last year. The vast majority of these studies show health benefits in those who supplement with vitamin E. Out of all these studies, the media chose to use only one. Never mention any of the other 92, just one. That was the Journal of the American Medical Association report to unfairly attack vitamin E supplementation. So we have one study that is flawed, that is designed to fail, and in all probability, and has a result that's non-spectacular, and that gets the news. 92 other good studies, well-designed, that came up with good results using vitamin E, not a word. New evidence is emerging suggesting vitamin E play a critical role in countering the potential oxidative damage and immune function breakdown that lies at the root of many diseases like heart disease, various forms of cancer, diabetes, kidney disease, Parkinson's, retinitis pigmentosa, and infertility problems and pregnancy complications. Vitamin E has also been shown to be pivotal to the normal functioning of important cellular processes, which enable the body to fight off disease. The exciting part of recent studies is that they are demonstrating the various mechanisms through which vitamin E seems to elicit its therapeutic benefits. Besides attenuating oxidative damage, as it does in relation to lipid peroxidation, research is now showing that vitamin E also modulates the expression of activation of signal transduction pathways. In cases of malignancy, such as cancer, these pathways seem to be dysfunctional and unable to inhibit growth and promote apoptosis in cancer cells. Meanwhile, its success in subduing lipid peroxidation platelet aggregation and inflammation associated with atherogenesis also seems rooted in vitamin E's ability to inhibit the activity of protein kinase C, or PKC, and consequently modulating the signaling pathways in which it's involved. Cancer is another area of study with regard to vitamin E that is similarly yielding positive tidings about the nutrient's role in both treatment and prevention. A study by German researchers, for example, now shows that alpha-tocopherol succinate, an esterified vitamin E analog without antioxidant properties, can selectively kill malignant cancer cells without harming normal cells. Unlike the toxic effect of the popular chemotherapeutic drug adriamycin, which does that. Earlier research by the same investigators had shown that alpha-tocopherol succinate could induce apoptosis or cell death in Jurkat T lymphoma cells in human colon cancer cells. In the latest study, a number of cancer cell lines, as well as several kinds of normal cells, were subjected to treatment with alpha-tocopherol succinate. Results showed that all the malignant cell tests were susceptible to alpha-tocopherol succinate, a dose of 15 micromoles per liter for a 12-hour period induced apoptosis in 65% of the cells, including leukemic cell lines, B and T lymphoma cells, as well as lung cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer cells. Meanwhile, no apoptotic effect was observed in normal cells, such as the fibroblast or endothelial cells or cardiomyocytes or smooth muscle cells. So it kills the bad cells and protects the good cells. And while vitamin E's ability to inhibit cancer growth, such as pancreatic cancer and breast cancer and prostate cancer, has been shown by in vitro studies, now researchers at the University of California found that the micronutrient may also serve a purpose in warding off gastric cancer, too. And for fertility, apart from heart disease and cancer, vitamin E has also been recognized in terms of its ability to improve sperm function and promote healthy pregnancy. Although this role was demonstrated several decades ago, in Japan, researchers demonstrated that vitamin E protects trophoblastic cells. These mediate fetal implantation and form a thin membrane to cover the fetus against oxidative stress in the region of the placenta during this development. Alpha-tocopherol, vitamin E transfer protein, is known to bind alpha-tocopherol, and is associated with vitamin E deficiency, and it's been shown in patients with ataxia. In essence, vitamin E helps prevent infertility. Now, to the question of gamma-tocopherol, I would suggest 20% gamma-tocopherol. I feel that that would be the best way of getting it, and that way you're making sure that you're getting what you need. So what it comes down to, and I'm just giving you information on two of the latest studies, what the Journal of the American Medical Association report helped confirm is the fact that taking a high dose of a single antioxidant may not be an effective way to prevent lipid peroxidation. And since most serious supplement consumers, certainly the people in this audience, know, take combinations. There is a synergistic effect when you're starting to take all those different nutrients together. For those of you just joining us, I'm Gary Noll. Welcome aboard. We're talking about health and nutrition today. This comes from Emma Ross, AP medical writer, Leon France. Eating lots of preserved meat such as salami, bacon, cured ham, hot dogs. Someone must have been looking at one of my family members' kitchen. That could increase your risk of bowel cancer by 50%. It's a major study. However, when it came to changing people's eating habits? Well, don't know about that yet. The latest findings come from an ongoing study experts say is the most reliable research into influence of diet on cancer to date, involving 500,000 people from southern Greece to northern Norway. And he said, quote, the results are very preliminary. There's more narrowing down that has to be done before we can draw any conclusions. But at least at the European Conference on Nutrition and Cancer, held by the World Health Organization and the International Agency for Research in Cancer, experts say the findings show the issues is complex. But in lay language, what does it mean? Remember, a hamburger is the same kind of meat. When you get a hamburger, just so you're clear of this, you go into one of these fast food restaurants, you could have the meat from 1,000 different cows in that hamburger. Bologna, salami, thinking of all the pizzas, you're increasing your risk of colorectal cancer. Let's take a look at some other things here. When we get an informed consent, so that we're told that, you know, what we should know. This is an article by G. Scott Crowther. And I thought it was very revealing. It's about dental fillings. Oh, I want to remind you that we are winning big time in California. The state is thinking about dissolving the state dental board there. That's good news. And all on the mercury amalgam filling issue. I'm telling you, this is going to be bigger in time and more important in on so many levels than even the tobacco legislation. And that's because not everyone smokes, but everyone has silver fillings in their mouth. Probably 99.9% of the population. 100 million new fillings a year are put in people's mouths. And after a series of reports we did, four-point series on called Toxic Teeth, all the results of which and the reports up on my website, GaryNull.com, it's being used by consumer groups. And in the state of California, it has been brought up. It's being debated. The American Dental Association has now been officially sued in a major class action suit. Dentists are having a lot of second thoughts about putting silver fillings in. So you see, good things for social change can come if you do your homework and have something that we can benefit from. So that's one good thing. Fluoridation is the next issue. And then vaccines. Here's what he says. Dental amalgam restoration consists of 50% mercury, 35% silver, 13% tin, 2% copper, and a trace element of zinc. After an amalgam is installed in a tooth, it slowly releases mercury and other metals into the body. Every amalgam daily releases on the order of 10 micrograms of mercury into the body. There's a growing body of scientific documentation that indicates mercury released from amalgams does great harm to the body. The amalgam has been used to restore patients' teeth for more than 160 years. It has both widespread and systematic use by dentistry. With state statutes which require some form of informed consent before amalgam is installed, it becomes appropriate for a dentist to install it if the patient concurs with the information presented. I believe that a state statute requiring informed consent by obtaining before amalgam installation is inappropriate in the anti-amalgam movement because of the following fallacies. One, it's contrary to tradition. Quote, I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor support any such counsel. While I continue to keep this oath unviolated, may it be granted to me to enjoy life and the practice of the arts respected by all men in all times. But should I trespass and violate this oath, may the reverse be my lot, unquote. That's the oath of Hippocrates, 500 BC, that every doctor and dentist takes. Informed consent for the installation of any harmful product, such as amalgam, does not adhere to the timeless principles of the Hippocratic Oath taken by Western physicians for nearly 2,500 years. Dentists take the Hippocratic Oath upon graduating, and because of the 2,500-year tradition of the oath, our society assumes that dentists will abide by it. So it is my belief that statutory informed consent, which permits the installation of a harmful product such as amalgam, does not adhere to Western tradition and our society's assumption. Requiring informed consent pertaining to the placement of a harmful product, which is a standard of industry, into a healthy person by a healthcare professional is contrary to Western tradition. Number two, it originally was meant for experimental purposes. Quote, the voluntary consent of the human subject for an experiment is absolutely essential. This means the person involved should have legal capacity to give consent, should be so situated as to be able to exercise free power of choice without the intervention of any element of force, fraud, deceit, duress, overreaching, or other ulterior form of constraint or coercion, and should have sufficient knowledge and comprehension of the elements of the subject matter involved as to enable him to make an understanding and enlightening decision, unquote. That's the Nuremberg Code of 1947. And by the way, that would mean that based upon that grounds, that there's no reason to take it. I would not use that even for a vaccine because, again, the idea is that you're not getting something harmful into a body. You're getting something that is benefiting the body. And they can't prove that it's benefiting the body without harm. So the whole concept is wrong. Informed consent, which became formalized per the Nuremberg Code, was meant for voluntary experimental purposes. It was not meant as an approach to healthcare for procedures and products that have widespread and systematic use. The amalgam is a standard product that has widespread and systematic use by the dental profession. It is placed in the teeth of many patients on a routine and non-experimental basis. Two purposes of informed consent per the Nuremberg Code are, one, provide the patient with complete information on which to make a decision prior to an experiment, and two, protect the physician from liability, provided that the procedure is properly executed according to the prevailing standard of care and without negligence. And in general, the experiment should, one, yield fruitful results for the good of society, procurable by other methods, and two, not be conducted where there is a reason to believe that death or disability will occur. Well, number three, it usurps government responsibility. The patient, who probably is a voter and taxpayer, has participated in developing a government system that today has legal authority and responsibility to police the products and material used in medicine and dentistry. Most patients trust this system to watch out and protect them from harmful products and materials. But it has lost its responsibility. The FDA has not approved the combined constituents of the amalgam for use as a dental restorative material. The amalgam is truly a rogue product. Informed consent gives personal approval for amalgam installation and usurps government's responsibility. And when it comes time to push the FDA to review amalgam safety, they may be more reluctant to do so if state informed consent statutes exist that justify amalgam installation. That is, state informed consent statutes indicate that dentists can use the amalgam if a patient concurs. And also it ruins professionalism. The difference between a professional person and a technician is that I think this is very important that we just focus a moment on this, is that a technician knows everything about his job except its ultimate purpose and his place in the scheme of things. The patient may doubt his relatives, his sons, and even his parents, but he has full faith in his physician. He gives himself up in the doctor's hands and has no misgivings about it. Therefore, it is the physician's duty to look after him as his own. And that was by Chakara Circa. The dentist completes a graduate school curriculum that educates him in the science pertinent to his profession. He then becomes licensed to perform his service as a professional. With true professionalism, the fundamental decisions of a practice, such as proper material to use, are made by dentists. The fees of patient pays for the services, reimbursement for these professional decisions. If a dentist is required to inform a patient of the products and material used and does so, the first responsibility for this choice is then on the innocent and trusting patient. The amalgam then becomes a consumer product instead of a professional product. Thus, professionalism is ruined by statutory informed consent. And five, it provides statutory permission for dentists to use the amalgam. Quote, "A prince never lacks legitimate reasons to break his promise," unquote, by Machiavelli. The amalgam is a rogue product that does not have institutional approval to be placed as restorative material in patients' teeth. If the dentist did not inform a patient that the amalgam contains mercury, then he is responsible for placing amalgam in the patient's tooth. Statutory informed consent requires that the dentist inform a patient about amalgam contents, depending upon how the statute is written. A dentist is then given statutory permission to install amalgam if consent is given by the patient. If done, it will be biased information. Bias and impartiality is in the whole eye of the beholder, said Lord Baronet. Well, there is a tremendous amount of information pertaining to the amalgam. The amalgam is a standard product, and the complete amount of information pertaining to it will never be presented to an uninformed patient during the time that he sees a dentist. If the dentist follows through with informed consent before installing any amalgam, there is going to be a bias with the limited amount of information that can be presented. This bias will be favorable to amalgam installation. And seven, it's very rarely ever done. Quote, "The more I study the world, the more I am convinced of the inability of brute force to create anything durable," unquote. Napoleon Bonaparte. Well, he learned a lesson about brute force. Dictation of a certain bias won't be performed through a person who does not have it. A dentist who knowingly performs a harmful act by installing a silver amalgam filling is rarely, if ever, going to adhere to informed consent with the patients being affected just because the statute exists. The greatest fear of amalgam installing dentists is disclosure. They will not disclose themselves. Denial of sin is simply human nature. And eight, it may make amalgam removal unethical. Most patients may agree to amalgam installation because they don't know, don't understand the science, don't know the toxicity, and they trust the government and their dentist to watch out for them based upon the age-old traditions. Also, the immediate cost of amalgam is much less than a composite restoration. The decision of the majority of patients will set the morality. If a majority of patients agree to amalgam installation based upon information provided during informed consent, then amalgam removal may become an unethical act. Thus, patients may become locked into harmful situations based upon informed consent. And this has actually occurred all over the country. For example, I know doctors in both Florida and California who, when patients went to them and said, "We'd like to get our mercury silver fillings taken out," they said, "Fine." They took them out, replaced them with restorative material, composites, and the doctors brought up on charges. So you're supported if you put the mercury fillings in the person's mouth. You're condemned if you take it out. And those are just some of the reasons that I believe that people should not be using the informed consent on mercury fillings as a way of getting around the idea that, gee, we gave informed consent, we're off the hook. No, you're not. You have an ethical moral responsibility as a dentist to know that if a dental filling is so toxic that if you put it in a person's, if you held it in your hand with a mask off your face, that would be considered a violation of EPA standards on handling toxic waste material. When you remove a mercury filling from a person's mouth, you cannot just throw it in a wastebasket. It has to go into a special red container that's toxic material, biomaterial. How is it that you cannot reason that if it's so toxic that it increases neurological toxicity and methyltoxylation within the individual dentist, it's toxic before it goes into the mouth, it's toxic when it comes out of the mouth, how can you justify it's not toxic in the mouth? You know it, I know it. The gig is up there. Now, coming up, an inside look at the FDA's sordid drug approval process. You want to know how those toxic drugs get approved? I'm going to take you on a journey. That's on tomorrow's show. I'm going to show you all of the special interest groups who have dominated the FDA peer review system, an old boys network. They're making a ton of money, and he who has the power has control. And we will show you the kind of control they exercise. Bias against alternative medicine strikes again. I'll show you how they've done that. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Good news. New evidence has been accumulating. I'll show you what hyperbaric can do for you. Then we're going to take a look at some good things. Probiotics and eczema, natural medicine getting new respect. Compound in vegetables reverses cervical dysplasia. And an argument that someone was making on the web that was so absurd, I'll tell you, there is 90% of what I read on the internet is disinformation, misinformation, or propaganda. And I just don't believe that people can appreciate how much intentional misinformation goes out. You've got to check your facts, check your resources. And some fellow was putting out the information that vegetarians are not as healthy or long live or have the same incidence of vitality as meat eaters. And meat eating prevents cancer. And it went on this whole, and heart disease, and went on this whole rationale. I read his first summation and I read his documents, and I could drive a truck through it tomorrow. I will be driving a truck through that argument. Sudden death and stress. Sudden death and catecholamines and stress. I'm going to do a whole commentary tomorrow on radical healing and the rebirth of real science. I'm going to talk about the mysterious immune stimulators from the deep, the acoglycerols. Haven't heard about them? Nope, you will. Good news on the healing front. And also new information on new therapies that can help for hepatitis C. And the role of periodontal disease and other infections in the pathogenesis of atherosclerosis and systemic disease. And I'm going to take you on a little journey of what are the different nutrients actually doing in your body? Amino acids, essential fatty acids, antioxidants, proteins, probiotics, mixed carotenoids. I'm going to take you on that little journey tomorrow. So that's it for today. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be back tomorrow. Ongoing series on alternative healing. Looking at the issues and stories that generally do not get the attention they deserve, and I believe that you're right to know. I'm Gary Nall. Have a very nice day, everyone. I look forward to sharing more with you on tomorrow's program.